WWND. WWND. I think you've heard of WWJD. What would Jesus do? WWND is what would Noah do? What would Noah do? We often talk about the flood, the Noachian flood. Did it really occur? Of course, we know that it did. And that's a fascinating study, and we've covered that. But a lot of times, it's easy to do that and gloss over who is the man, Noah. He emerged on the scene when society was totally perverted. And God holds Noah in very good company. For example, when one of the places he's listed, we can go over to Ezekiel chapter 14. Ezekiel chapter 14 and verse 14. And I think that this is extremely complimentary to him. It says, even if Noah, Daniel, and Job were there, their righteousness would save no one but themselves, says the sovereign Lord. Now, there are several different points are being made, but the one that I want to focus in on is that Noah is in good company. He's listed with Daniel and Job. And for whatever flaws they had, they overwhelmingly were loyal to God. And they were close to him. They followed his directions. And they were extraordinary. No doubt they will be pillars in the millennium, in the world tomorrow, because of their expertise, their experience, and the fact that they were so focused spiritually on trying to obey God. And God is very complimentary. And Noah is one of these three. And he was not perfect. The Bible's clear on that. But he was phenomenal overall. What he was required to do took enormous vision, confidence, faith, and determination to be able to fulfill God's will in his life. Noah had enormous responsibility. And again, I raised the question, WWND, what would Noah do in the future if he were alive? We have a great deal of insight about what people will do in the future by looking at what they've already done in the past. And let me repeat that. To know what people in society are going to do in the future, it is important to know what they did in the past. So we're going to look into the life of Noah, the fabric of his life, to understand WWND. What would Noah do? There are three aspects that I think I would like to talk about that are worth looking at in depth. One is that Noah would not compromise. And if he were to be brought back to life today and see the society that's developing, he would say, oh, I've been here before. I have seen this happen. And it's unfolding the same way. And I want to encourage the brethren to do what I had to do, frankly, all by myself, with my family, that is. And that is to not compromise, not succumb to peer pressure. It's hard to withstand peer pressure, especially when you're alone. And I'll show you something that's unbelievable, but it happens. This was an experiment was developed at a university when they wanted to understand more about the pressure in society. And this is super simple, but it says a lot. I'm going to draw three lines here. Maybe I'm going to do that. Well, okay, your imagination comes in handy in a case like this. There's a line, imaginary line that goes here. That's line A. Line B goes only here. This is A, B, and C might go only there. Okay. Oh, very good. This guy earns his keep in so many ways. Anyway. Okay, make one a little distinct, longer than the other. Oh, and then we've got, oh, this one, same thing. Oh, I see. Okay, this is great. All right, A, B, and C. Okay, and this one, line C, is obviously the longest one. What they would do is take 10 students at a time, and they would tell the first nine, I want you to sit in a row, well, all 10 students sit in a row. And everybody in the experiment wanted to know what student number 10 would say. So they go to the first one, and they say, which line is longer? And he would say, line B. That's not true, but he would say that. The second one was asked the same thing in this room. Everybody's in the same room. Second one says line B is the longest. A third, fourth, all, they all say the same thing, all nine. And now there was a 10th student. He's sitting next to the others. He's the only one that doesn't know what's going on. And they ask him the same question, which line is longer? And he would say line B. 75% of the time. We're not talking about life and death. We're talking about going along with the crowd. Now, what happens if the people, the first nine say, well, line B is longer. Any blockhead would know that, you know. And if anybody doesn't agree with us, we're going to let them have it. That's ridiculous. But that is how human nature can be. It can succumb to that, to fear. Wanting to be accepted, wanting to go along. There might have been some people, I may be wrong, but there might have been out of the billions that were alive during the time of Noah, there might have been a few people that would say, you know, between you and me, this world is going downhill. But, to get along, you got to go along. And so people may have compromised that knew better. It's amazing how many people, quote unquote, know better in situations and will choose the lion bees in their lives and compromise and kid themselves. And this comes up many, many different times in different places. So society has a powerful effect on people. Now, I've used an example here once, but it says so much in just such a quick expression. Theoretically, this didn't really happen, but somebody was interviewed that lived next to the Daytona 500 racetrack. And they asked him, they interviewed him. They said, sir, do you think that living next to the Daytona 500 has any effect on you at all? And the answer was, well, no, I don't think so. We deny it, but it's true. It's true. And so you can sympathize, empathize with Noah or other courageous individuals like the Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego that worked with David. And they were on a collision course with the king of Babylon. That's unsettling when you know that you can't get out of a confrontation and it's going to happen and you're thinking, this isn't going to go well. But with God's help, it can. With God's help, Romans 8:28, all things can work together for good. So, the three lads, Jewish lads, decided that they were going to stand up to Nebuchadnezzar and his golden image. They already put their lives on the line when they refused to eat the king's diet because it was inferior. Maybe it had unclean food, I'm not sure, but in the first chapter of Daniel, you can read about that. And that was a very, very bold decision on their part. And then here you could ask, well, what could be more challenging than that? To be standing on the plain of Shinar and then looking out and seeing a million people and the golden image that probably was arranged to be erected at sunrise when the light could sunlight could reflect off of it and could be sparkling where everybody could see it from far distances. And then everybody's asked to bow down, and then you see three people still standing. And they would be immediately identified. And then they would be immediately hauled off to Nebuchadnezzar. And when he, most of the time, in those cultures, you had like the law of the Medes and the Persians, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. And if somebody does an infraction, they get punished. We don't care about, we don't listen to any reasoning about appeals or assertion of innocence. You committed the crime, according to us, that's it. Into the dungeon or to death or whatever it is. That was the way it was back then. And Nebuchadnezzar broke a protocol when he asked those three lads to come forward. He wanted to know who they were, and then he recognized them when they got closer. And then he did the unprecedented thing. He went against his own decree, and he says, I'll give you another chance. I don't want to lose you. But when you hear all the music instruments played, then at that time I expect you to bow down and show obeisance to the golden image. And they said, O king, and they had a relationship. They said, O king, we are very careful not to do this. And if we die, we die. Basically, that was the vernacular. That was what they told him. And you know the rest of the story. They survived the fiery trial, the fiery furnace. Now, they had each other. Maybe, I don't know if they were married, perhaps not. They could have been eunuchs. I don't know. But they had a broad circle of friends. They were among other Hebrew students that were indoctrinated into the Babylonian culture. Noah, on the other hand, was all by himself. Well, he had his family, yes. But he didn't have a peer group like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They had each other. So it was even more demanding for Noah. I find that fascinating. Noah was on a collision course with society, and one of the important points to draw from this is that we are too. We are too. And that we see a lot of parallels between Noah's life and our lives. And it even says in Matthew chapter 10, we can go to verse 22. Matthew 10, verse 22. I'm reading from the NLT, New Living Translation. Most of the time I feel most comfortable, especially when doctrinal matters arise, with the King James. But in this case, there are some nice illustrations that are brought out here. In Matthew chapter 10, in verse 22, it says, and all nations, this is prophecy for the future, Christ speaking here, all the nations will hate you because you are my followers. But everyone who endures to the end will be saved. Will be saved. When you are persecuted in one town, flee to the next. I tell you the truth, the Son of Man will return before you have reached all the towns of Israel. Or as we saw in the first message, that the great harvest could be closer than we think, and it's wise for us to be spiritually alert on that. Now, in 1 Peter chapter 3, it's a very significant scripture that I think fits well in what we've looked at, because we're going to get the attention of the world. Some people are not going to like what we have to say, and other people will be happy to hear it. And in 1 Peter chapter 3, oops, in verse 15, is an important scripture. 1 Peter 3, verse 15. It says, instead, you must worship Christ as Lord of your life. And if someone asks you about your Christian hope, always be ready to explain it. Now, why would somebody ask us if they saw within us a good example? Maybe we seem extra calm at a time when there's turmoil in the world. And if society gets rattled, that we don't get agitated or lose our spiritual equilibrium. And most importantly, it says, and if someone asks you about your Christian hope, what we believe in, what we expect to happen, what we know will happen with God's direction and Christ returning to the earth, we have a lot to be thankful for. We have more reason to have peace of mind than most people. As time goes on in the future, people are going to be more nervous and edgy. People reaching for drugs, for alcohol, for other means of relieving stress, and not always the best choices there. A lot of that is going to play out in a negative impact on society. Again, I'm dumbfounded that's one of the big leading problems on campuses today among youth that should have their lives in front of them, should be full of energy and excitement. They're turning to drugs, and depression is epidemic with a lot of the youth. And those are the best, or could be some of the best years of one's life. And to see that go down the drain is a tragedy. And if people, they're struggling, and they see you as a neighbor, a coworker, a friend, a relative, and you're not fretting the way everybody else is, that may be because you have hope of the future. You know how it's going to play out. And they may sense that. And as one person said to one of our faculty members years ago at the college, "Harry, I want what you have. I don't know what it is exactly, but you're not rattled, you're not agitated, you're not worried, and you seem to be at peace." Or as it says in the Olivet Prophecy, "In your patience possess ye your souls." So Noah was not rattled by the criticisms and the life standards that were set at that time during his life. And instead, he was committed to spiritual endurance. And just like a marathon race, it's not over until you cross the finish line. And so it is that Noah had to keep going. I don't think when he started the project of constructing the ark and warning the world that it was going to take as long as it did. According to Josephus, I don't know where else to independently corroborate Josephus, but according to Josephus, Noah took 40 years to gather the materials for the ark, then he took 40 more years to build the ark, and then 40 years to warn the world about it. 120 years. It's a long time to be in the public spotlight because people would be talking about it. Boy, have you heard what's going on over in this region? This wacky guy, I don't know where the money comes from, but he's building this stupid boat, and there's no water for 100 miles. They're going to have a canal. Come dig that. And you can just imagine the verbal assaults and the anger and the ridicule that would come up from all people that just knew he was wrong. Of course, Satan had to be behind that. It reminds me when Mr. Armstrong was raising up the college, or even before that. There was a time when he was just trying to make the ends meet, doing an early work and having radio coverage in the Pacific Northwest. One person just out of the blue just walked up to him, accosted him, and said, "Mr. Armstrong, you're not going to get very far. No, because you teach the truth, and the truth people don't like, and they won't put up with it." In other words, you're wasting your time. You better quit while you're ahead. Don't put your family through this. There's a million reasons why you need to chicken out and just call it a project and move on. And 1947, the college that he started, well, with God's help, I think, it struggled. You know, they couldn't meet payroll. Then because of that, 50% of the faculty left. And because of that struggle at the beginning, they were hoping to have 20 or 30 students. They ended up with 4. And because everybody else said, "I can't wait for these guys to get their act together. I'm out of here." And so it was that he started with a few. And he talked about how the one property that they had created financing for, how that was in trouble, that they were facing bankruptcy just out of the starting blocks. It looked pretty grim. And people would say one after another, quote, "When this thing folds up, what are you going to do? When it folds up." You know, these were his friends, his associates. He said he was so discouraged. And he didn't do this for 120 years. He said he was so discouraged. When the city of Pasadena came in, inspected the property, before they could bring in students, they had to renovate. And renovation doing the plumbing over again would be, back then, $25,000. He said, "I only had $2,000 coming in every week. Where was I going to get $25,000? And then the fire department came and inspected and condemned the building for a fire code violation. That'd be another $25,000. And then A third was plumbing and fire and electric. That was a disaster. Knob and tube wiring that was as old as electricity was in the country. That was a nightmare. And so that required a lot of money. He didn't know where it was going to come from. And it looked like the people were perhaps correct this time. And so he prayed. He repented of it later. He felt so awful. That night when he went to bed, he prayed that God would take his life. He was middle-aged. Please just take my life. Don't wake me up until this is all over with. This is a nightmare. He said, I had not yet learned how to put my trust on God's shoulders. I was in over my head. I couldn't do it by myself. But now that I'm studying the Bible, I was never supposed to do it by myself. So it was that he woke up the next morning, and that was a different day. And he couldn't believe it. Thousands of dollars were in the bank account that came in. And then the next day, another $5,000 came in. And then another $3,000 the next day. And by the time it was over, I think the total was $50,000 for everything. I thought it was $75,000, $50,000. But it all came in. And then after it came in, the weekly income went down to just where it was before this whole thing happened. But somebody was looking out for him. But that was a test of endurance. That was being convicted. And it worked. There have been times since the people would go to him and say, when this thing folds up, the treasurer would say, he would tell Gerald Waterhouse all the time, I give this place six more months, mind you. I handle the ledgers. I look at the accounts. I know what's coming in and so forth. 6 more months, we're going to fold up. Sounded pretty convincing. I mean, he's the treasurer. Kept on going. I've heard things, well, United Church of God is bankrupt. It's going to be, mark my words. Anyway, I've heard people say different things, make prognostications, and don't own up to what they said all these years later. Human nature run amok. But the point being that Noah had to do it, he was by himself, and he did it for a long time. That takes incredible focus like we've perhaps never seen or heard of. Although maybe somebody in a hospital ward somewhere has been there for ages and is going through some huge trial and is riveted and is focused, and God is still God, and I need his help, and with God's help, I'll be able to accomplish whatever. And the test of endurance goes on. Now, we are all enduring different things, and I remind ourselves, Matthew 24, verse 13, he that endures to the end shall be saved. Not he that endures for 20 years and says, well, you know, it's time for me to do something else. You can't run away from your calling. We juggle many other interests and activities, yes. But God is always supreme. He's always there for us. We are called to do a work as well as to overcome and to change and be different people, be more on his wavelength, to root out the weeds that are in us. So it's an exciting opportunity. Let's move on here. One of the reasons, the secret that goes on. I've already quoted Matthew 24, verse 13. But in Genesis 6, in verse 9, we're going to see the real primary reason why Noah was effective, why he could endure. Now, I don't know how much time he spent every day in communication with God, but it had to be significant. It had to be a considerable amount of time to be able to withstand Satan and all the criticisms of society and be able to put God first and be locked on for the long haul. Saying to God in prayer, you know, I'll stay the course for another 5 years if you want. And the ark isn't finished yet, and I'm getting all kinds of criticism. But if you want, I'll hold out for another 5 years or another 25 years, or whatever, whatever the amount, whatever it takes. I don't think that God told Noah, oh, all you have to do is to hang in there for 46 years, 3 months, and 2 days. Any more than he's going to say to us in this time, Christ is going to come back, but we're not going to give you the hour or the day or the second or the minute. And yet, so many people try to figure it out. In Genesis 6, in verse 9, it says, this is the account of Noah and his family. Noah was a righteous man. That's quite a statement. And the only blameless person living on the earth at the time. Amazing. And he walked in close fellowship with God. I like the way that's translated in New Living Translation. He walked close in fellowship with God. He stayed with God every day in prayer, study, and until he had the sufficient energy to be able to fight the battles of Christianity in a very godless world. And he was, in God's view, blameless at a time when the earth was increasingly corrupt. It's difficult to withstand opposition when it's scattered, but when it's concentrated and it comes full force, that's even more of a challenge. And the people that succeed in staying the course are generally people that are saying, I'm not going to wait till the crisis happens in order to get serious with a relationship with God. The time to turn to God is not when Christ has landed on the Mount of Olives and he's taking care of things and you're way behind the learning curve. Now, we need to be ahead of the learning curve. We need to review the prophetic indicators that we know are happening that lead up to it, because just as it was in the time of Noah, so it is in our time today. And therefore, our efforts matter. Our determination should emulate that of Noah's determination. When we ask WWND, what would Noah do? That is like asking, what should I do? Same thing, same difference. And Noah had to endure for years, and very likely many years longer than we have had. But it says over in Matthew 24, as it was in the days of Noah, so it will be in the time of the Son of Man. I'd like to spend some time there in Matthew 24. At the heart of the Olivet prophecy. There are many prophecies in the Bible, but the Olivet prophecy is at the core of everything, dealing with Christ and his return. Matthew 24. And there are warnings about us not getting distracted in the end time. If somebody says, oh, the Messiah's out in the desert, don't. You know that wouldn't be the case. Or if this sign appears and you don't see it predicted in the Bible, then you would probably be very wary of that. Verse 30, and then at last the sign that the Son of Man is coming will appear in the heavens, and there will be deep mourning among the people of the earth. And they will see the Son of Man coming in the clouds with great glory. And learn from the lesson of the fig tree, verse 32. When its branches bud and its leaves begin to sprout, you know that summer is near. In the same way, when you see these things, you can know that his return is close, even at the door. I tell you the truth. This generation, this final generation, will not pass from the scene until all of these things take place. We're going to see a lot of excitement in our lives, most all of us here. Excuse me. And nobody knows the day or the hour. Verse 37, when the Son of Man returns, it will be like as it was in Noah's day. In those days before the flood, the people were enjoying banquets and parties and weddings. There's nothing wrong with those things. But in this context, it's presented as a distraction away from what is most important. So while people were enjoying all these things and trying to live life, right up to the time that Noah entered his boat, people did not realize what was going to happen until the flood came and swept them all away. That is the way it will be when the Son of Man comes. You have a perfect parallel here. Two men working in the field, one will be taken, the other left. Two women grinding flour at the mill, one is taken, another left. You must watch. You do not know what day the Lord is coming. And if we knew, then people wouldn't be caught by surprise. But it takes character to be self-disciplined, to not follow a person on the other side of the ledger, ignore everything. But there was no doubt persecution, just like everything else that was degenerate in the time of Noah, is predicted to repeat itself if it hasn't already. I will turn to 2 Timothy 3. You're familiar with that passage, I'm sure. And we probably turn to it more often these days because we're seeing more and more the fulfillment of the dangerous and outrageous activity that man has engaged himself in. And sin is becoming abundant and so many different things going off track. So in chapter 3 in verse 1, you should know this, Timothy, that in the last days there will be very difficult times. The people will love only themselves and their money. They will be boastful and proud, scoffing at God. There are just so many examples to cite, but to save time. Disobedient to their parents, oh yes, and ungrateful. As far as chaos, as far as people losing it in this end time, Newport News, Virginia, a few days ago, there was a first grade kid that got into an altercation with his teacher. Well, that's bad enough. Then the kid left the big school building. He went home, got a gun, came back, and shot his teacher. I guess that's Newport News justice for you. Not really. Society has gone crazy. And the more these things happen, the more callous people are about it. And some of these people, just like this first grader, maybe he'd seen so many thousands and thousands of murders on television and killings and so forth. You know, these things desensitize people. In Noah's time, he was butting heads with a very desensitized society. And we are going to experience that again. We're already getting some pushback, you know. No, I can't have your magazines here. No, we're not running your telecast. So we keep landing on our feet with other alternate things to do, to connect with the people that don't want to hear a message in many cases. And yet there's so much good with it, hope. And I find that the more you talk about that, the more excited you can be about it. And that's why I keep referring to Mr. Waterhouse, who had the privilege of speaking about the millennium at least 5 days a week. And it becomes part of you. And that also can be reinforced even if you're building a boat. And it's going to take you 120 years from start to finish. And I'm sure he got some resistance. There may have been some people that wanted to praise him, but they didn't want to come out and say that they were supporting him or believed in him. In Christ's time, when Christ died, a few people came out of the woodwork and they thought, well, I've never wanted to go public, but yes, I endorse Jesus Christ. And they would do that maybe at the risk of their lives. When the Declaration of Independence was written up, there were probably 60 or so signatures on it. The most notable, John Hancock. When he wrote that, he says, there, I think King George can read my autograph without his spectacles. And most of the people that signed that document were tracked down and killed. They put their lives on the line when they signed that document. That is the kind of world that can be made manifest, where people are sarcastic and critical and intolerant of others that would represent the truth, would represent God. because they had become so depraved, so degenerate, and so closed-minded to what God would say. You know, when they in a small town in Kentucky, a man replicated Noah's Ark to exact scale. We'll look at a few pictures of it. And to me, that's fascinating. You walk through there and you say, this is absolutely amazing. If you ever have a chance to go see it, and some of you have, but if you ever have a chance, highly recommend that. Well worth the money. We went in there and we spent 6 or 7 hours there trying to read everything. Anyway, it was quite the experience. And Noah had to have great vision and determination to hang in there and to do it. Now, what I was going to say was, even though all the people on day one were very, very impressed, there was a group of people that were protesting it. They said, this is a hoax. Noah's Ark is a hoax. And the people are confused. They don't understand science. This is an embarrassment. And so they marched around and made their noise. I can imagine some of the criticism. People saying, where's the water for the boat? What you're going to build? What's all this lumber laying out here for? You're going to build a boat? How long do you think it's going to be? 40 years. Well, I think it's a bad idea. But I tell you what, I'm unemployed. Maybe you can hire me on for 20 years. That could have happened. I don't know if Noah and his sons built that all by themselves. I don't know. If you stand up next to it and you look at how massive it is, you just have to wonder. There could have been a lot of people that helped. And if that happened, I don't know. It would take me a million years if I had to do this by myself. Even with Legos, you know, those toys. I could struggle with that. Well, I don't want us to look at any of the other things. It'll be distracting. But people could say, well, who paid for this monstrosity anyway? It's 100 miles away from the closest water. Or, no, you think you're really something with that? Why don't you build 5 more arcs? That way, you can handle the overflow. Ha, 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 if you ever get any.
The overflow?
Yeah. Or, hey, when you're done with the ark, can you build me a pirate ship? Ha, 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 ha. You know what? Your stupid boat is an embarrassment to our neighborhood. Because of you, we'll never land a Super Bowl here. We'll never have an Olympics game here. Noah, your boat is an embarrassing eyesore to the community. Either you take it down or we'll burn it down. People get aggressive. That's a problem. Just shocking how people can be so negative, and go out of their way to do that. When I was at Ambassador College, there was a person that had this Ambassador Report. Every month it came out. I never read it. I just heard about it. But it was a checklist of all the things that were going wrong with the college, the church. And I would hate to live a whole life and look back and think, well, the only thing I ever did was to throw darts of criticism at other people that were actually doing something. Something that turned the world on its ear, in my opinion. So Noah was extraordinary. One of the things that was a blessing is he did something that a lot of us struggle to do sometimes. He followed directions. If he didn't follow directions, this would not have happened. God said, I want you to build an ark. It's going to be 510 feet long. It's going to be 75 feet wide and 55 feet tall. Or is it 55, 75? Anyway, it doesn't say one way or another, but I think that there might have been some extended guidance as to where to put the pillars on the inside. To me, that was the single most fascinating thing, was to how would you build a structure so that it was had strong integrity, it was intertwined, it was powerful, reinforced, beams that were, oh, maybe a third the length of this wall, that wide, and going up for three stories. Just phenomenal. So why don't we take a look at some of these pictures here. You just start anywhere. Keep going. Now, here's a speculation of what kind of a room, what kind of living quarters the eight people on the boat could have. And to me, it was all realistic. You've got tapestry, you've got quality linen, and you have blankets and shelves, and they would certainly have the space. When you study Noah's Ark, you have to ask yourself, what did Noah do with all that room? Because think of it, most of this marine life just stayed in the oceans. And you can see that there were thousands and thousands of cages that are on the Ark, the replica of the Ark. And anyway, oh yeah, one of the people, that one of the great critics is Bill Nye, the science guy. And he says, oh, these guys are hopeless. Well, no, he didn't say that, but I felt that he was implying that. And he said, for example, these dinosaurs, you can't tell me that they had dinosaurs stored up in those rooms. They didn't. He doesn't understand that there were two floods. There was a Noachian flood, but there was a pre-Adamic flood, pre-Adam. And back then is when there was a flood and when dinosaurs could live and then die. And so Noah did not have to fill up his ark with dinosaurs. So they take up a lot of space. Anyway, let's move on to some other. Another area where they're doing maybe metal shaping for tools, future tools, when they would be on land again. Let's go on. See these huge beams? When I grew up, lived in New England, we lived in a farmhouse. It was a couple hundred years old, and they had exposed beams. They were beautiful. And it'll be the only thing standing after the Great Tribulation, probably, when hailstorms and all these other things happen. But here, you've got enormous beams, and then others that are maybe three times this width, they're running vertically in strategic places that had to hold this thing together. Let's keep going. So I wonder, this is great. No, go back. See how huge these things run? And then all the way down? How long does it take to cut out a beam like that? Just astonishing. But it happened. I mean, what is also amazing, it took modern man 2 years to build this replica. That's with 11 cranes to hoist up all this heavy stuff. It took 2 years. And Noah didn't have any cranes. So they must have had pulley systems. And you just have to imagine, if people are hoisting up the pillars, it just seems to me that there had to be more than Noah and three sons to do that. Four daughters. Or four women. Just unbelievable. But mankind could do it. It was a challenge, even with modern equipment. But to go back thousands of years, that says something. But Noah followed directions. I'm wondering, did God say, now here's where to put these interior pillars for the best results? If the answer is no, God did not have to tell him, then maybe Noah was an engineer. Maybe he studied construction. But this is in a world class of its own. It's not like there are 20 stepping stones where somebody started off with smaller boats and then created this. Okay, let's keep going. All right, here are some of the cages this is very, very plausible. It's for real. And thousands of them. And then ingenious, the way they could get rid of excrement, it would run through the, into shafts, the way they could air condition the ark and suck in air, air into vents. So many other things that's, it's beyond the scope of and time of the restraint of this, constraint of this message. Let's keep, yeah, keep going. Anyway, there more, you can see more of the different places where the animals could be. And just hit a few more. And there's a lot of video on the internet that you could go home and watch that illustrate in detail quite a bit of what's here. Okay, that's good. Just, it's an amazing, you know, wonder of the modern world, of the ancient world.
There was Noah.
Oh, there's Noah?
Yeah.
Well, he gets around. He's okay. Remember, fans, folks, you saw it here first. But God had said at one point he regretted that he had even created man. But Noah was willing to do God's will, and he did follow the directions. And if he didn't, if he, it could have been a disaster. For example, the shape of the ark is like a cigar, and under turbulent water it won't flip over. But they show in one of the displays what it's like if you have a top heavy boat and you simulate wild waves, and the thing would flop over every time. The ark was designed so that it wouldn't do that. And that's just ingenious. And there's a lot of things on the ark that you'll, if you get there, you'll see that. It's very, very interesting. And it's heartwarming to see people go through it and children. We saw a lot of them that day from the Amish community that believe in God. And to the whatever extent they understand, they cherish his laws and his ways. So, and when we pray, I know I do, I pray to God about the end time. I know that the message could be unpopular in some circles, but I remind him, please help us to complete, you know, the ultimate blessing is to complete our effort to warn the world and give it hope and predict a wonderful future. And there are seven, it's figuratively speaking, 7,000 knees that have not bowed down to Baal. There are, in other words, many other people out there still that believe in God, that would be receptive to what we have to say. And it seems like people are more receptive recently. There's just more activity with new people. And they need to know this. They need to hear this. In Hebrews 11, Noah is mentioned as one of the great men of faith. And it says in Hebrews 11 that he and other saints have not received their full reward. No, they haven't. And when they're brought back to life, it seems as though God will have a great deal of work for them to do. They will be supervising many other people. And because of the outstanding character that they developed, God is going to entrust them with the to have enough expertise to manage an increasing population of people. So I need to conclude this. I asked, what would Noah do? Well, we know that he would not compromise, and he would not succumb to peer pressure. That is an inspiration for us, because we're going to live in a society, in a time, in an era that's just like what Noah faced. And then Noah walked with God. Genesis 6 and verse 9. He walked with God. He spent time in prayer with God. He was close enough to do what it took. And then thirdly, he followed God's directives to the letter. He had to. Otherwise, the boat would not perform. and for it to be able to provide a quality of life for the inhabitants that dwelled on it. It was significant that it was constructed perfectly. And so it seems as if that was the case. And just a fantastic development. So again, Noah would not compromise. He walked with God. He followed the directions. And he had success. We should follow in his footsteps. When we ask, what would Noah do? We're asking, what would we do? The final thing I'd like to leave is, one of the supreme tests, I think, was after all of that work and getting, and then the animals finally came, and people maybe scratched their heads. Well, maybe there's something to this. Ah, but I'm not going to risk my reputation. I'm not going to be the next one that jumps on his bandwagon. No. But for seven, after they came in, the door was locked. God locked the door to the ark. And did it rain? Didn't it happen just the way God told him it would? No, it didn't. Not then. A whole day went by, and all was normal on the outside. Weather was good. People yelling down at Noah, "You're a fool. You need to get off this boat before you ruin your family." Second day went by, nothing. Third, fourth, fifth. 7 days, nothing happened, except they could hear the insults out away from the boat. After the seventh day, it got ominously cloudy, and you know the rest. Water poured out of the sky and burst up from the ground, and all the human race was destroyed. If we want to succeed where they failed, we have to do what Noah did. We can't compromise. We have to, again, walk with God, and we have to follow his directions. If we do that, we'll have our own successful voyage, and we too will be able to meet Noah and join forces to do eternal work in the kingdom of God.